Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 68.
Tang Sanzang and his disciples, as you know, their quest continues. This part drops us right into their travel, specifically when they arrive at this, well, intriguing new city. What's really cool from the get-go is how the source just immerses you in the atmosphere. You get these poetic descriptions, things like sea pomegranates blooming like brocade or lotus leaves unfolding like green plates. It really paints a picture of that intense summer heat they're dealing with.
Right, you can almost feel the heat, and as they're pushing through it, suddenly, boom, a city appears on the horizon. Tang Sanzang, always the cautious one, pulls up his horse and asks, "Disciples, what place is that over there?" And here, this is where that classic dynamic, you know, between the master and Wukong really kicks in. Wukong, with that mix of being playful but also super sharp, just fires back, "Master, you really don't know how to read. How'd you even get the Tang Kings okay to leave?"
Huh, yeah, it's quite a jab.
Totally. And Tang Sanzang, of course, he gets defensive, says he's been a monk since he was a kid, knows thousands of sutras, but Wukong doesn't let up. He insists he should recognize the characters Zuzi Kingdom, that's the Vermilion Purple Kingdom, written right there on the city's flag. Tang Sanzang kind of mumbles something about the wind blowing the flag around, obscuring his view. A likely story.
It really highlights that humorous tension between them, doesn't it? It's great. And what's interesting is how Baji and Sha Sing, at first, they actually side with the master. They doubt Wukong, saying, you know, "We can barely see the city. How can you read the flag from here?"
Good point, actually.
But Wukong, true to form, with his amazing eyesight, just confidently says, "Is it not the three characters?
Zuzi Kingdom."
So right away, it establishes Wukong's incredible vision, setting him apart from the others. And once Tang Sanzang hears the name, he clicks, "Ah, a Western kingdom. We'll need to get our travel permits checked here."
So they finally get closer, right up to the city gate. They dismount, cross a bridge, go through these like three layers of gates. And the description, wow, it's painted as this truly magnificent imperial capital. You get phrases like high gate towers, neat battlements. It's surrounded by flowing water. It got high mountains nearby. Sounds bustling, too. Six streets, three markets, just packed with abundant goods, 10,000 households, thriving businesses. Yeah, it's really hyped up as a great city, even a heavenly capital with foreign trade and tons of jade and silks. Impressive.
And that setup, that initial grandeur, is really insightful, I think. It depicts the kingdom as this peak of like worldly order and prosperity. They even mention three passes strictly guarded, suggesting eternal peace. So this isn't just some random town. It's presented as a symbol of a well-run, secure civilization, which makes it a really significant stop on their journey. And it sets up a powerful contrast for what happens almost immediately after.
Right, the contrast. Because as the master and disciples start walking through the main streets, their first look at the locals is actually pretty positive. They're described as dignified, neatly dressed, their speech is clear, reminding them of home, the great Tang world. Gives them a bit of comfort, maybe.
A fleeting moment of familiarity, yeah.
Fleeting is the right word, because that calm just shatters the second the public really gets a good look at the pilgrims themselves. Shopkeepers literally drop everything, abandon their businesses, just to stare. They're gawking at Baji's, well, ugly appearance, Sha Seng's dark face and tall stature, and Wukong's hairy face and prominent forehead.
Yeah.
You can just picture it, right? A busy street grinding to a halt, everyone just pointing and staring.
Oh, absolutely. It's such a vivid scene. And what does that reaction tell you, do you think, about how their whole spiritual quest keeps crashing into, well, everyday reality?
It's jarring, and Tang Sanzang feels it immediately. The text says he's practically sweating, urging his disciples, "Don't cause trouble, keep your heads down."
Yeah, his anxiety is palpable. It really shows how their physical appearances, which are so out of the ordinary for these people, become their own kind of obstacle. It's different from fighting demons, you know.
It's a Libra kind of challenge.
And it gets worse. While some folks eventually go back to their business, the idlers and children, they actually start throwing tiles and bricks at Baji, just to tease him.
Oh, man, poor Baji. That's chaos.
It really is. Creates this genuinely stressful, anxious situation for Tang Sanzang. He just wants to get them out of there.
So, yeah, with the crowd getting rowdy, they quickly decide to duck down a side street. Smart move. And they spot this building. It has Hui Tong Guan written above the gate, the Hall of Meeting and Union. Tang Sanzang recognizes it instantly, tells the others it's a place where all under heaven meet and commune. Basically a guest house for travelers and officials. He suggests it's a good spot to rest up before trying to see the king about those permits.
And Baji's reaction to finding this place is just classic Baji.
Yeah.
He apparently pulls out his snout, like makes a big show of it, and scares off dozens of the onlookers who are still following them.
Effective, I guess.
Definitely effective. He grumbles something like, "Good, let's hide from these noisy birds." It's his own very unique way of crowd control. It gets them out of a tight spot.
Clears the path. So they go inside, and the crowd finally disperses. Inside this Hutong Grand, they meet two officials, and their first reaction is basically, "Whoa, what kind of people are these? Where are they going?" Total surprise.
Understandable, given the crew they're looking at.
Right. But then Tang San Zhang explains. He says he's a monk from the East Earth Great Tang on this sacred mission to retrieve scriptures from the West. And he explains, very humbly, that he wouldn't dare pass through without permission and needs to exchange travel permits. And could they possibly stay there for a bit?
And the official's response is, well, it's really telling about the protocols of the time. The text says they dismiss their attendants, adjust their attire, and descend the hall to greet them. Proper formal greeting.
Wow, so a complete shift from the street reaction.
Absolutely. They immediately order a guest room to be cleaned and tell someone to prepare simple vegetarian provisions. It shows they instantly recognize the importance of the mission, the status of these travelers, despite, you know, Wukong making a little joke about not getting the main hall.
Yeah, Wukong always has to get a word in.
It reflects that respect for envoys on these kinds of major journeys. That protocol is actually key to their mission succeeding.
So after the officials leave, a steward comes in with the food. And the list is so specific, I love it. We get a plate of white rice, a plate of white flour, two bunches of green vegetables, 4 pieces of tofu, 2 pieces of gluten, dried bamboo shoots, and wood ear mushrooms.
A decent spread for simple provisions.
Totally. Tang San Zhang tells the disciples to accept it gratefully, but his mind is already elsewhere. He immediately asks the steward about meeting the king. That's his priority.
And this is where it gets really interesting, a twist. When Tang San Zhang asks if the king is holding court, the steward says something quite unexpected. "Our emperor has not held court for a long time."
Oh.
Yeah.
That sounds significant. Not just a day off then.
Exactly. But then the steward adds this critical piece. "Today," he says, "is a propitious day." And the king is actually making an appearance, sort of. He's issuing a yellow proclamation with his officials.
A proclamation. So not exactly holding court, but he's out.
Right. And the steward stresses, this is vital for them. If they want to get those travel permits exchanged, they must hurry now. Like, right now.
Why the rush?
Because, the steward says, tomorrow it will be impossible. He even warns they might have to wait an unknown amount of time if they miss this very specific, very narrow window today.
Whoa. Okay, so that just throws a major wrench in the works. Mystery and urgency all rolled into one.
Absolutely. Yeah. What seemed like a standard bureaucratic step suddenly becomes this race against time, clouded by this weird fact about the king.
So this is a real curveball, isn't it? Talk about pressure. It creates this immediate, palpable sense of urgency for Tang San Zhang. He's like, okay, disciples, quick, prepare the meal, and please, please don't cause any more trouble.
Keep a low profile while I'm gone.
Exactly. While he rushes to get the travel permits verified before this tiny window slams shut. And then Baji steps up. He quickly fetches the kasai, the ceremonial robe, and the permit for his master. Quite helpful for once.
Tripitaka, Tang Sang. He arrives at this magnificent place, the Five Phoenix Tower, in the Zuzi Kingdom's palace.
And his goal seems simple enough.
Yeah, just get the travel pass exchanged.
Yeah.
Official business.
But the king there, the king of Zuzi, he's really sick. Like,
yeah.
Desperately ill.
And seeing Tripitaka, this revered monk, he's actually overjoyed.
Right. And that meeting, that simple formality, it just flips immediately into something much deeper. A revelation, almost.
Yeah, a huge revelation.
And what's so clever here, I think, is how this minor task, this administrative thing,
yeah,
it becomes the perfect moment for Tripitaka to lay out the real story, the foundational reasons for his whole pilgrimage.
He doesn't just say, I'm going west for scriptures.
No, no. He gives the king this sweeping history lesson, connects his journey straight back to the Tang Dynasty's fate.
It signals right from the start, this isn't just a personal quest.
Exactly. It's tied to heaven and earth, you know,
yeah.
The whole dynasty.
And what a history lesson it is. It's incredible. Tripitaka goes way back.
He does. He touches on the mythical foundations, the three sovereigns, the five emperors.
These almost legendary figures, the sort of cultural heroes of ancient China.
Right. Then he moves through the big names, Yao, Shun, Yu, Tang, these sage kings.
And then brings it through the actual dynasties, right? The Zhu,
yeah.
Qin, unifying everything.
An, Jin, the whole messy southern and northern dynasties period, the Sui.
Leading right up to the present day for them. the glorious Tang Dynasty under Emperor Taizong.
And this whole historical recap, it's not just name-dropping.
No, it feels deliberate.
It absolutely is. It's meticulously building this sense of, like, divine and imperial legitimacy for the quest.
Ah, okay, so it's grounding the journey.
Precisely. It's showing that this mission has this incredibly deep lineage. It's ordained, you could say.
By earthly powers and heavenly ones.
Yes. It connects Tripitaka's personal spiritual journey to China's whole historical and kind of cosmic destiny.
Wow. Okay, so it's like him saying, this isn't just my idea, this is bigger.
That's a great way to put it. It's the journey for the whole civilization, rooted in its past.
So that huge historical context then brings us to the really specific kind of supernatural event that actually launched the quest.
Yes, the trigger. Emperor Taizong gets mysteriously ill. Well, this Dragon King, he was responsible for rain in Chang'an, the capital. But he messed with the rainfall amount. He was in trouble, like celestial trouble. So he actually appears to Emperor Taizong in a dream.
In a dream. Okay. Asking for help.
Begging for help. He's afraid he's going to be executed by the heavens.
Okay, this is where it gets wild. Taizong promises to help the dragon.
He does. Promises to intervene.
But then, and get this, one of Taizong's own ministers, Wai Xing, who's known for being incredibly wise.
Super capable minister, yeah.
He dream kills the dragon. While Wei Xin's asleep, apparently playing chess with the emperor to distract him, his spirit goes and carries out the execution.
Taizong technically broke his promise.
Because he couldn't prevent it, even though he tried.
Exactly. So the dragon, now a ghost, files a complaint in the underworld.
Against the emperor.
Against Emperor Taizong, accusing him of breaking his word.
The emperor's life, the fate of the empire, it's suddenly caught up in underworld legal proceedings.
Pretty much. Underworld bureaucracy determined his fate.
Wow. Okay. So connected the dots. Taizong's serious illness and, well, his actual death.
Were the direct result. Karmic consequences for that broken promise.
But like you said, the story doesn't stop there. He died, but...
But Wei Xing, the same minister who killed the dragon in a dream, he's also prepared for this. He writes a letter for the dead Emperor Taizong to take with him.
To take to the underworld. Who's it for?
It's addressed to a guy named Kui Zhu, an underworld official, specifically the judge of Fengdu City.
Fengdu City. Isn't that like the legendary capital of the underworld?
That's the one where souls get judged. And Wei Zheng knew this judge from when they were both alive.
So it's like an old connection, a plea for help.
Exactly. And this letter, plus Judge Kui's compassion, he actually alters the records.
Alters the underworld records. What does he do?
He finds Taizong's name in the register of births and deaths, sees he's fated to die, but he takes his brush, adds a couple of strokes to the character representing Taizong's remaining lifespan.
And gives him more time.
Gives him an extra 20 years of life. And allows him to return to the living world after being dead for 3 days.
Wait, hang on. So the emperor gets 20 extra years.
Hmm.
And Tripitaka's whole mission, it all hinges on a personal letter and a judge in hell basically fudging the paperwork.
That's essentially it. It's an astonishing level of detail, isn't it? The cosmic bureaucracy is very specific.
That's mind-blowing. So that whole sequence, the dragon, the dream, the killing, the underworld trip, the fudge documents, the resurrection.
That is precisely why Tripitaka is heading west.
Because after Taizong comes back to life,
he's shaken. He realizes he needs to appease all the wrong souls, especially those who died unjustly. So he decides to hold this massive ceremony.
The Grand Dharma Assembly. The text calls it a Waterland Great Assembly.
Yes, to save souls trapped between worlds. But for that ceremony to be truly effective, he needs the authentic Mahayana scriptures, the Great Vehicle Scriptures.
Which aren't available in China. They're only in the West.
At Lian Monastery, Buddha's place. And the Bodhisattva Guanyin had already indicated that only someone like Tripitaka, a truly virtuous monk, could undertake the perilous journey to get them.
So the emperor's personal karmic debt and his subsequent religious obligation directly create the need for this epic quest.
Exactly. It's not just a general desire for Buddhist teachings. It's a very specific requirement stemming from these supernatural events.
Okay, wow. So as Tripitaka is telling this absolutely incredible story to the king of Zuzi, what's the king's reaction?
Well, you hear his response. He's completely awestruck, but also deeply lamenting.
Like lamenting.
He compares his own situation, his long illness, his feeling that he lacks good ministers to this amazing story he's just heard from the heavenly great kingdom of Tang.
So he feels inadequate compared to Taizong's dramatic experience in recovery.
Yeah, he feels his own kingdom and his own suffering pale in comparison, and he doesn't have a Weijing or a Judge Kui to help him.
And Tripitaka notices the king's state too, right?
Oh, yes. Tripitaka observes him, notes he looks really unwell, jaundiced, emaciated, and weak, spirit decaying. It's a stark contrast to the story of Taizong's revival.
A real visual difference between the storyteller's origin kingdom and the listener's kingdom.
Definitely. But even in his despair, the Zhu Zi king is respectful.
Right, he invites Tripitaka to eat with him.
Yes, in the perfumed hall, sharing his own royal vegetarian meal.
Wukong, Shaseng, and Baji.
Settling in.
And Shaseng's trying to sort out some tea, maybe a meal. But uh-oh, problem.
A very relatable problem.
Totally. They need seasonings for cooking. They're out of oil, salt, soy sauce, vinegar, the essentials.
Can't make much without those.
Nope. So Wukong, you know, steps up. He offers Baji, that's Pigsy, some money to pop out to the market.
And this is where we get classic Baji, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. What does he do?
He immediately tries to get out of it. And his excuses are just, well, they tell you so much about him.
Forget what?
His vanity, for one. And how he loves to exaggerate things. He says his ugly face will scare everyone.
Right. He mentions that time he supposedly scared like 10 people just at the gate.
Exactly. And then he imagines this total chaos in the market, thinking he'll scare loads of people to death and then he'll be blamed for it all.
It's so over the top. What's really going on there, you think? Beyond just being lazy.
Well, it's that insecurity, isn't it? He focuses on his looks, maybe because deep down he feels like an outsider.
Mm.
And it's definitely a way to dodge responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, maybe a little bit of thinking the world revolves around how people react to him.
Yeah, that makes sense. He just wants the easy route. But Wukong, Wukong's clever.
Oh, very.
He knows how to handle Baji. How does he actually get him to go?
He doesn't argue about the face or the chaos. Smart move.
Right.
Instead, he just changes tack completely. He starts painting this incredibly detailed, like mouth-watering picture of the market.
Ah, food.
Exactly. He lists everything. Hotels, rice shops, mills, silks, nice tea houses, noodle shops, big flatbreads, steamed buns.
Okay, I'm getting hungry now.
Me too. Good soup, spicy stuff, good vegetables, and then he hits him with the really good stuff. Exotic sugar cakes, steamed pastries, dim sum rolls, fried foods, honeyed foods, just lays it all out there.
Wow. And Baji's reaction.
It's instant. Like, physical. The text says his mouth watering, his throat gulping.
Ah, predictable.
Totally. He just jumps up, says, okay, okay, I'll go. And even promises to treat Wukong next time. Food is definitely his trigger.
It really is.
Yeah.
But that market description, it's more than just motivating Baji, isn't it? What does it add to the story, seeing all that detail?
Well, it definitely grounds the story, like you said. Even with gods and demons running around,
yeah,
people still need to eat, trade, live their lives. It reminds you that basic needs, basic desires, they're always there, even on this epic quest.
And it paints a picture of a pretty lively, maybe even prosperous place.
Absolutely. It shows a functioning society, lots of goods, lots of activity, which actually sets up a nice contrast for what they find out later.
Okay, so Baji's finally convinced. Food did the trick. He and Wukong head out. They get directions to Zeng's general store near the drum tower.
Should be simple enough.
You'd think. But Wukong has other plans. He starts messing with Baji.
Of course he does. How?
They walk past several places, tea houses, restaurants. You know, and Baji's like, hey, let's just buy stuff here.
Makes sense. Get it done.
But Wukong says, nah, let's walk a bit further. Find a bigger place for food. Just dangling it in front of him.
Oh, that's classic Wukong teasing, leading him on.
Totally. And yeah. The text even notes that people start following them. They're this odd couple drawing attention.
Is Wukong just having fun, or is there maybe something else going on? Is he sensing something?
Really good question. With Wukong, mischief often has a point, doesn't it?
It usually does. He might be observing or maybe just creating an opportunity for something to happen. And making Baji wait makes his later reaction even stronger.
So they finally get to the drum tower, and the atmosphere changes, right? It's not just a casual market stroll anymore.
Not at all. It's packed. The description is intense. Countless people clamoring, jostling, filling the street. It's a real crush of people.
And Baji, how does he handle that?
He freaks out again, immediately thinks it's some kind of trap, maybe to capture monks.
Ah, paranoia kicking in.
Right. He's terrified of causing a scene in that crowd. So what does he do? He leans against a wall, turns his back to everyone, and basically pretends to fall asleep.
His go-to move. Avoidance.
Exactly. If it's overwhelming, just check out. But it also shows you, doesn't it, how vital these public spaces were for information. A crowd like that means something important is happening.
No social media then. This was the bulletin board.
Pretty much. And while Baji's doing his ostrich impression, Wukong gets proactive.
What does he do?
He just pushes right into the crowd and uses his special eyes, his fiery golden eyes, to see clearly what everyone's gathered around. It's an official notice, an imperial proclamation.
Oh, okay. So not groceries anymore. What does the proclamation say?
It's pretty serious stuff. It's from the Zuzi king of self.
Right.
He says, you know, the kingdom's been great, peaceful, doing well, but he's incredibly sick.
How sick?
Gravely ill, bedridden, lingering for a long time, difficult to cure. His own doctors, the Imperial Medical Academy, they've tried everything. Nothing's worked.
Wow.
So the proclamation is basically a giant help you wanted sign. He's calling for anyone, literally, wise individuals from all under heaven, doesn't matter where they're from.
Northeast, China, foreign lands.
Exactly. Anyone skilled in medicine. And the reward. Well, it's staggering.
What is it?
He promises to give the person who cures him half the kingdom's foundation.
Half the kingdom?
Half the kingdom. And he stresses, no empty words. He means it.
That is desperate.
Mm.
And an unbelievable opportunity. So Wukong reads this.
Mm-hmm.
What's going through his mind? Not exactly the soy sauce mission he started on.
No kidding. His reaction is pure Wukong. He's apparently full of joy.
Joy, really?
Yeah. He quotes a saying, action brings fortune. Sees this not as a problem, but as a chance.
Okay.
And right then and there, he decides, forget the scriptures for a day. He's going to play doctor.
Just like that. Wow, that's a massive detour from their main quest.
It is, but it shows his confidence, right? His opportunism. He sees a problem, sees a reward, and thinks, yep, I can handle this. It's such a brilliant narrative. Turn the mundane shopping trip slams right into this huge royal crisis.
Okay, so new plan. Cure the king, but first, he needs that proclamation, right? How does he grab it from the wall with everyone watching?
Well, that's where the magic comes in handy. He does it so smoothly.
Tell me.
First, he creates a little distraction, bends down, drops the bowl they were meant to buy seasonings with.
Okay.
Then, quick as anything, pinches some dirt, tosses it up, whispers a spell. Invisibility charm activated.
Nice.
He just walks forward, unseen, lifts the proclamation right off the board. Simple as that.
And getting away.
Just as slick. He takes a breath of immortal ki, blows it out, and creates the sudden whirlwind.
Covering his tracks.
Exactly. Dust flies, people are distracted for a second. By the time it settles, he's already back near the wall where Baji is still.
Pretending to sleep.
Looks like it. Still leaning there, totally unaware of anything that just happened. And Wukong, he doesn't even wake him. Just gently folds up the proclamation, tucks it away in his tunic, and starts heading back to the Hall of Meeting and Union.
The crowd under the drum tower sees the proclamation disappear in this gust of wind.
Mm.
You've got the 12 eunuchs, 12 imperial guards who posted it just hours before. They must be panicking.
Oh, definitely frantic. I mean, this is a royal decree for it to just vanish. It implies something serious, maybe supernatural. It really shows how desperate the kingdom is.
And imagine the scene when they search around and
they
spot this piece of paper sticking out of Pigsy's pocket. So they confront him, right? And Pigsy, he's still groggy, totally confused. What's his first reaction?
He just instantly denies it, gets really defensive, blustering, you know, you son of a bitch took the imperial proclamation. Your grandson knows how to heal. Classic Pigsy.
Yes. So characteristic.
It really is. He's grumpy, blames everyone else, hasn't even processed what's happening yet. It's his go-to. Avoid, deny. But the funny thing is, his denial, combined with the fact that he has the paper, just convinces the crowd he must be the one who took it. He's playing right into Wukong's hands without even knowing it.
Okay, so then he finally looks down, sees the actual proclamation sticking out of his own clothes. What happens then?
Well, then he gets really mad, curses Wukong, that ape is going to be the death of me. You know, and his immediate instinct is just to destroy the evidence, tries to tear the thing up.
But the crowd stops him.
Oh, yeah. They're desperate. They grab him, insist he has to come and cure the king. He's their only hope now, as far as they know. A few brave or maybe foolish people grab hold of him.
And this is where we see Pigsy's other side, his sheer stubbornness.
Exactly. His strength. You've got maybe 10 people pulling on him, trying to drag him off.
Yeah.
But he just stands there. The text says, like, he grew roots, completely immovable.
Wow.
It's a great image, isn't it? All that strength. But he's using it just to resist, to not do something. His reluctance is literally this immovable force.
And he even warns them, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Something like,
Yeah, he basically says, keep pulling and you'll trigger my stubborn streak, and then don't blame me for what happens. It's pure Pigsy, half threat, half just sheer exasperation. You can almost hear him sighing.
Okay, so the crowd's stuck. Pigsy won't budge. What happens next?
Well, then two older eunuchs step forward. They seem a bit more level-headed. They try a different approach, ask him about his strange appearance, his voice. They just want an explanation.
And Pigsy, surprisingly, actually tells them the truth, even though he's annoyed.
He does, yeah. He lays it all out pretty clearly. He says, you know, we're monks from the east going to the west to get scriptures.
Yeah.
Mentions his master, Tang Sanzang, the emperor's royal brother, is actually at the court right now dealing with their travel papers.
So he's being completely honest about their mission.
Totally honest. And he doesn't spare Wukong either. He tells them exactly how the Monkey King tricked him with the proclamation, and that Wukong went back to the Hutong Inn where their luggage and the horse are. It's very matter of fact, even though he's clearly irritated by the whole situation.
Right. It shows that for all his complaining and laziness, Pixie's often just brutally honest. Maybe too honest sometimes.
Exactly. And then comes this little comedic moment, a bit of social awkwardness.
Yes, the grandma incident. Tell us about that.
So Pigsy, trying to be maybe complimentary in his own rough way, refers to these two elderly eunuchs as grandmas or nannies, nine-eye, because, he says, they're sensible, they know what's what, basically.
Okay. I can see where this is going.
Right. The imperial guards nearby are absolutely scandalized, calling court eunuchs grandmas, and Pigsy just fires back something like, you've got yin and yang reversed, or you've got it all backwards.
So it's funny. After all this back and forth, the huge crowd.
Yeah.
The text says no less than 300 to 500 people.
Yeah, a massive crowd.
They basically escort the very unwilling Pigsy to the Hutong Inn. It's like this giant accidental parade.
It really is. And then Pigsy actually gives them some surprisingly useful advice, crucial advice, actually.
About how to handle Wukong.
Exactly. He warns them, says, look, my senior brother, Sun Wukong, he's fierce and serious, not someone you mess with. He tells them you need to approach him properly, perform a great ritual, address him formally as Master Sun.
Okay.
Otherwise, Pigsy says he'll just get difficult, change his mind, and refuse to help. No healing will happen. It's Pigsy, you know, despite being dragged into this, actually trying to make sure the king does get cured by managing Wukong's ego. He knows his brother.
And the officials. They buy it. They're willing to do this.
They're absolutely desperate. They basically say, look, if this Master Sun cures the king, he deserves half the kingdom. We'll bow to him, whatever it takes. Their desperation completely overrides any sense of courtly pride or protocol at this point. They'll play Wukong's game. Got a feel for Pigsy here at the start. Him just fuming.
Oh, absolutely livid. He's convinced Monkey King totally pranked him.
He's going on about these empty promises, right? Yeah. Said Monkey King was going to buy him noodles, flatbread, steamed buns, all vegetarian, of course.
And instead, Monkey King sneaks off, finds this royal notice, you know, the one offering a reward for healing the king.
And then just stuffs it in Pixie's pocket. Pigsy says he feels utterly betrayed, like, is this what brotherhood is, kind of thing.
But Monkey King's reaction is just, he plays dumb.
Totally innocent. Oh, did you get lost, Pigsy? I was just out buying seasoning and stuff, couldn't find you, so I came back.
Right. Just complete filmed ignorance. It kind of sets the stage, doesn't it? You know straight away he's got something up his sleeve.
And while Pigsy's still probably muttering about this, suddenly court officials show up. Eunuchs, imperial guards, the works.
Yeah. Unexpected. And the way they approach Monkey King is really striking.
Immediately, it's Sun Grandfather, super respectful.
And they're saying things like, heaven sent you down. The king's got such good fortune, they want him to use his great economic hand.
Which sounds a bit grand for a doctor, but okay.
Well, it implies more than just medicine, right? It's like his ability to fix huge problems, bring order from chaos. And then there's that phrase.
The slightly apply three times the force in adjusting a bone.
Exactly. Wei Shi Sun Shi Gong. It's an old reference to an almost legendary healer. So they're not just being polite. They're acknowledging some serious, almost miraculous power they perceive in him.
So they've clearly connected him to that proclamation Pigsy had. They see something unusual.
Definitely. And Monkey King. He just switches gears. The playful act is gone.
He confirms it. Yeah, I revealed the proclamation, and this, pointing at Pigsy, is my junior disciple. Send him to introduce us.
But then comes the bombshell. He quotes that saying.
Medicine doesn't follow the seller. Illness doesn't seek the doctor.
Meaning, basically, if you're serious about getting cured, you come to the real expert. The expert doesn't chase you.
So, based on that, he demands the king himself has to come and personally ask him for help.
Yep, and declares he has this power. The handy cure illness dissolves thing, like an instant cure.
Pretty much. It's incredibly bold. He's dictating terms to royalty.
How do the officials react? They must have been stunned. Oh, the text says they were astonished. Yeah, shocked probably. But then they have this really interesting thought process.
What's that?
They figure, Guju Danyan beyond the Yumudun Yang. Basically, anyone who talks that big must have the substance to back it up.
Huh. So they don't see it as arrogance.
No, they see it as confidence born from real ability. It's quite astute, really. So they split up, half stay behind, very respectfully, just waiting.
While the others leg it back to the palace to tell the king.
Right. Talk about a quick strategic shift. They recognize the power dynamic immediately.
Imagine that scene at the palace. Guards and eunuchs bursting in. 10,000 fortunes, Your Majesty!
Yeah, and the king is actually there talking with Tripitaka, the master monk.
So they excitedly tell him, Holy Monk Elder Sun revealed the proclamation, but he wants you to come get him.
The king apparently is overjoyed, just pure hope. And he
Yeah.
turns straight to Tripitaka, right? Asks him about his disciples.
And Tripitaka, he goes full humble monk mode.
Totally. Calls them mountain wild common talents. You know, Shan Yi Yunkai. Basically says they're just good for carrying bags and leading the horse.
He even downplays their famous skills. Oh, they just, subdue a few demons, catch some monsters, wrangle tigers and dragons, that sort of thing.
And then flat out says, none of them know anything about medicine.
Maybe trying to stay out of it, or just genuinely underestimating Wukong in this area.
Could be either, or maybe just extreme modesty. But the king isn't buying it.
No, the king shows some real wisdom here, doesn't he? He brushes off Tripitaka's humility.
Calls it Tian Yuan, like heavenly fate, a destined meeting.
His logic is simple. If this disciple couldn't heal, why reveal the notice and why make such a huge demand for a personal invitation?
Exactly. The king concludes this guy must have Yu Guozhi Nengye, the ability to heal the whole country. He sees the big
And it's
picture.
a great moment. It shows the king's not just some figurehead.
For sure. And he acts decisively. He's too sick to go himself, apparently can't even manage his carriage.
So he sends literally his entire court, civil officials, military officials, the whole lot.
To Doom King, respectfully invite Divine Monk Elder Sun. That's Monkey King's new title now.
And the key instruction, Ki Bu King Man, absolutely no disrespect.
And use Jun Shanzi, ruler subject etiquette. Treat him as if the king himself were there. This is huge, elevating Monkey King before he's even done anything.
So back at the guest house, picture this massive delegation arriving, all these high officials lining up, bowing low.
Must have been quite a sight.
But while this is happening, where are Pigsy and Sandy?
Hiding. Pigsy's apparently peeking from a side room. Sandy's plastered against a wall
Remember,
somewhere.
Pixie's whispering, complaining that Monkey King is who what is it shy you?
Basically killing us with embarrassment
Yeah.
because Monkey King is just sitting there calmly, doesn't move, doesn't return the bow, doesn't even stand up initially.
Talk about nerve, just absolute composure.
He waits until they finish their whole bowing routine. Then he stands up.
And what's the first thing he says?
Straight back to his original point. Why didn't your king come? He's still holding his ground.
Wow. Even after that whole display of respect from the court.
Yep. He makes them explain again. They repeat that the king's too ill and that they're there with Dajin Z.
Substitute ruler's etiquette, like, we're acting for the king.
Right. And only then, finally, does Monkey King agree. Okay, I'll go with you.
But just before they leave, Pigsy says, But whatever you do, please don't mention us. Basically. Which, given Pigsy, is probably wise.
Probably.
And Wukong, he pulls Pigsy and Sandy aside.
Yeah, it gives them some last minute kind of weird instructions. But the really interesting part is he tells them to Shuyao.
Collect medicine.
Yeah, collect any medicine people send for me and make sure you count it all. Wukong arrives. He's volunteered to cure the king, who's been sick for a while. But, things don't exactly go smoothly right off the bat, do they?
Not at all. I mean, the source tells us his appearance. It's described as fierce or tricky looking.
Okay.
And his voice, so a sharp, loud, fierce voice. It's so alarming that the king, who's already ill, mind you,
Yeah.
he gets basically scared stiff, falls right onto his dragon bed.
Wow. Just from seeing him and hearing him?
Yep. He's so terrified they have to help him back into the palace and he's yelling, Do you know you scared me to death?
Oh, man. Talk about a disastrous first impression, like really bad.
Absolutely. And the court officials, they are definitely not impressed either.
I bet. What do they say?
They accuse him of being rude and rustic, basically.
Okay.
And of rashly taking down the notice, acting without permission, just barging in.
So they're calling him out. And Wukong's comeback. Knowing him, it's probably not subtle.
Not subtle at all. He just laughs, tells them, you know, you've completely misunderstood me.
Uh-huh.
Then he hits them with this zinger. With such slow-witted people around, the king's illness, it won't get better in 1,000 years.
Ouch. He's basically blaming them for the king staying sick.
Pretty much. And he doubles down, says the king will be a sick monarch now, then a sick ghost when he dies.
Oh, my goodness.
And then out him, he'll be reborn as a sick person. So still not well in 1,000 years. Just lays it on thick.
That is harsh. I can imagine the official's reaction.
Oh, yeah. They call it us. It's just full of nonsense. Utter rubbish. They're furious.
Okay, but here's where it gets really interesting, right? Because Wukong doesn't just, like, storm off. He completely shifts gears.
Exactly. From insulting everyone and scaring the king, he suddenly pivots and launches into what sounds like, well, like a lecture from a seasoned physician.
Yeah. He even recites a poem about diagnosis. What's that about? What principles does he lay out?
This is really the core of the medical wisdom here. He recites this.
Inspection, auscultation, olfaction, inquiry, and palpation are the four essentials. Lacking even one, the diagnosis isn't complete.
Wow. Okay, so the four essentials. Wang, wen, wen, qi.
Okay, so first is wang, which is inspection, he says. Observe his spirit, his complexion. Is he moist or withered, fat or thin, awake or asleep? Looking at the whole picture.
Got it. Observing. What's next? Next is wen, which covers both listening and smelling, auscultation and olfaction, he says. Xie, listen to his voice. Is it clear or turbid? Hear his true words, but also his delirious talk. It includes smell, too, implicitly.
Okay, so observe, then listen and smell. Then there's another wen.
Right. The third is also wen, but this one means inquiry, asking questions. Ask about the illness's origin, how many days it's lasted, what's his diet like, how are his bowel movements, getting the history.
Makes sense. Observe, listen, smell, ask. What's the last one?
The fourth is qi, which is palpation, specifically pulse taking here. Palpate the pulse to understand the meridians, whether the pulse is floating or sunken, indicating superficial or deep conditions. Feeling for clues.
So wen, qi. Look, listen, smell, ask, touch, feel. That's incredibly systematic.
It really is. He's outlining a complete holistic diagnostic method, not just focusing on one symptom.
And what's amazing is it's not just Wukong, this known troublemaker, saying this. The text mentions the imperial physicians, the Stieti.
Mm-hmm.
They're there, and they actually validate what he's saying. They confirm that even Hupu, immortals treating illness, would use Wen Qi.
Exactly. It grounds Wukong's knowledge in established medical practice, even respected by the professionals in the story, which makes you wonder.
Yeah, if he knows his stuff this well, and even the court doctors agree, why is the king still refusing to see him?
That's the puzzle, isn't it? The king is just stuck on that initial fear. He keeps saying, just tell him to leave. I can't see strangers.
Still spooked. It's almost funny, but the poor guy's been sick for years.
Right. But Wukong, you know, he's never one to give up easily. He's got another trick up his sleeve.
Ah, okay. What does he propose?
He offers a legendary solution. For Wukong, suspended thread diagnosis.
Suspended thread diagnosis. What is that exactly?
It's this technique, mostly legendary but sometimes mentioned, where a doctor diagnoses the pulse using a thread tied to the patient's wrist without direct contact, often for reasons of propriety or maybe distance, or in this case, fear.
Wow. So, like, remote diagnosis via thread.
Kinda, yeah. And the officials, they react with fascination. They admit they've only heard of it, but never actually seen it done.
So even they're intrigued now.
Definitely. So they rush back to the king, tell him about this amazing offer. And the king, you know, he's been sick for 3 years. Nothing's worked. He finally agrees. Out of desperation, maybe curiosity too.
Okay, so we're finally getting somewhere. Wukong's gonna do the magic thread thing. But wait.
Yeah.
Doesn't his own master step in first?
Ah, yes. Right before Wukong can proceed, Tang Sanzang, his master, pulls him aside, and he is not convinced.
Yeah, I remember this part. Tang Sanzang's like, hold on a minute.
Exactly. He calls Wukong a naughty monkey, basically, and doubts him completely. Says point blank, you don't even know medicinal properties, you haven't read any medical books, how can you treat the king?
Which, I mean, from Tang Sanzang's perspective, seems like a fair point, right? Given Wukong's usual behavior.
It seems fair, yes.
Yeah.
He's thinking logically based on past experience, but Wukong...
He just laughs it off.
Totally laughs it off. Reassures his master, says he has just a few folk remedies, basically.
Uh-huh.
But insists that they can cure serious illnesses. He even jokes about it.
What does he say?
He says something like, even if I mess up and he dies, it's just the crime of a quack killing someone. It's not a capital offense. Tells Tang Sanzang not to worry, just watch.
Wow. That's peak Wukong confidence right there.
Yeah.
Flippant, but somehow reassuring.
Exactly. It's that mix.
So Tang Sanzang pushes back again, right? Asks if he's read the big medical classics.
Yes. He specifically asks about fundamental texts, like Touyu RRO, you know, the foundational books of traditional Chinese medicine.
And Wukong's answer isn't exactly, yes, master, I studied hard.
Not quite. Instead, he reaches back, pulls Hudungnaro, three hairs from his own tail, classic Wukong move.
Right.
Shouts, and transforms them into three silk threads.
There's the magic. So these are the threads for the diagnosis.
These are the threads. But what's really fascinating and shows his unique genius is the detail.
What detail?
The text specifies each thread is RO, long, that's Tuzhang and Four Qi. And Wukong explicitly says this length, Kora, corresponds to the 24 solar terms, or Qi, of the traditional calendar.
Whoa, okay. So it's not just random magic threads. The length itself has meaning tied to natural cycles and health and TCM.
He might not have book learning in the traditional sense, but he has practical knowledge, confidence, and, well, magic.